I never got any money from you.
UFO might just as well stand for unprecedented financial opportunity.
Be normal.
This is The Saucer Life, a podcast wherein we examine concepts, events, or people orbiting the world of flying saucers. Few preconceptions, snark when justified, no belief, no debunking. Today, we are going to look at a very, I don't know what to call it, a tiny case, a mini UFO case. It happened out on the Wolverton Trail in California and was chronicled in a booklet or a pamphlet that was 11 pages long, called The Wolverton Trail Incident, which was published in 1963 by the author Oscar F. Knight. And Oscar Knight was also the individual who had this strange, interesting, very, I think we can say, low-key contact and sighting experience. Now, while I had seen mentions of this pamphlet and things like George Eberhardt's Extraterrestrial Contactee Bibliography, which is a vital, vital publication for those in this, I don't know, we can't really call it a line of work. That seems a bit pretentious. Not as pretentious as In the Field. But those who like contactee stories, it's a good collection of sort of summary of all the different publications that were out there back in the day. But like I said, while I'd seen mention of this, I didn't really know any details until a listener got in touch a few weeks ago. Oh gosh, probably about a month and a half ago now, and had a copy of the pamphlet, a scan of the pamphlet, and this person who did not want to be identified in any way, let me know that that they had known the people involved in California back in the day, which was, and told me about the area a little bit. And it's really interesting. It's an interesting contact case. It's a little different from a lot of contact cases. It's actually a little different from all contact cases in some interesting ways. And like I said, this is an 11-page booklet, so this isn't going to be an epic journey. And the people involved, the people who had the experiences, were not the sort of people who dropped everything they were doing and dedicated their life to telling their story. They had this event. They published the booklet and got on with their lives, which is admirable, I think, to not put all your eggs in the flying saucer basket. So let's get into the Wolverton Trail event. I think the most effective way to approach this will be to sort of go through the event, the booklet, the Wolverton Trail event, and the events sort of depicted in there. I've said events a lot. And then we'll go into other things about what we know about the author, which honestly isn't a lot. Like I said, they basically, after this, seem to have gotten back to their regular life, which is unusual in some cases. So the copy I have, or I have photographs of, looks like a sort of cardstock cover, light blue. It's faded at this point. It says at the top, Wolverton Trail Event, in a serif font. And then below that is a hand-drawn symbol that looks like a cross inside a circle. And as I turn to inside the front page, there is a handwritten sort of epigram that says, "With love and understanding to people of Earth and our friends from other planets," which is nice. And in the foreword, Oscar Knight, the author, says that he wishes to express appreciation to his wife and some friends that he names for their, quote, effort and encouragement toward having this event printed, April 1963. You can write to the author, probably not anymore. Oscar Knight, 18331, Road 192, Strathmore, California. So there's an introduction that follows, but it's really just a summary, sort of a biographical summary of the author and contributors to the pamphlet. First up, we have Oscar Knight. Mr. Oscar F. Knight is a successful rancher living in Central California west of Porterville, where he and Mrs. Knight lived in 1955 at the time of the Wolverton Trail contact described in this report. He and his wife Kitty have owned and managed for several years their comfortable and well-equipped ranch where they raise cotton, walnuts, and fruit. We also learn about Carl J. Bueller. Mr. Carl J. Bueller, whose interesting letter is copied with his permission on page 10, was a ranger at the south gate of Sequoia National Park in 1955 when the incident occurred, which is described in this booklet. He heard of the Oscar Knight and Ken Holliday experience and went to see the Knights just before Christmas in 1962, at which time he told them he and other rangers had seen spacecraft. I do like the phrasing of the Oscar Knight and Ken Holliday experience. I know it sounds like some sort of progressive band like the Alan Parsons Project or something, but I just like the word experience there because it's not like the UFO sighting or the alien meeting or something like that. It's something much more non-specific because you don't really know what you're getting into. Now, before you think that these are just saucer people who don't have anything better to do than to make up stories about things, the introduction or biography section concludes by saying, quote, "The Knight and Bueller couples are well-liked and responsible citizens who have decided to tell their experiences because they believe people have a right to know the facts and make their own interpretations," end quote. I love this. I love this very much because you've got the very sort of responsible, solid citizen sort of thing. Like we're not insane. We're not making stuff up. We're not running a scam. We just want to tell you what happened and you can do with it what you will. Very, very non-judgmental, very non-pushy. So let's get into this. So the cover says the Wolverton Trail event, and then there's sort of a second title page after the introduction that says A Visitor from Venus by Oscar F. Knight. So we sort of know where we're going and what we are getting from this story. Now, interestingly, as it starts off at the beginning, and we're on page 1 of 11 of this book now, of the numbered pages, one of the things I notice, and this isn't a criticism, I'm not being snarky, this is just an observation, there is an element of things being kind of overwritten, kind of wordier than they need to be. So I don't know if... There's not many reasons why people overwrite. Maybe it's sort of just their style, or maybe they're trying to make something sound more sort of grand than it would be if you presented things in a more straightforward manner. I think sometimes it's the effect of being a rancher and not somebody who writes professionally or often, that you feel like you can't just tell your story. You have to tell it in an expansive, expanded way. So this is sort of the first two paragraphs of this, and the way it's written, it's so unselfconscious and well, maybe not unselfconscious. Maybe actually that's completely the opposite. Self-consciously trying to sound like a writer rather than just writing a story down, because there is a difference. There is always, among our friends, someone we particularly enjoy associating with in the great out of doors. Such a friendship has been established through the years with Mr. and Mrs. Ken Holliday and myself. In the Sierra Nevada is Sequoia National Park, containing many virgin areas of beauty, one of these being Moose Lake, located in the Great Western Divide some 12 miles via Wolverton Trail east of park headquarters. Our plans for a fishing trip to this lake culminated into action. As I was reading this and working on this episode, I was trying to figure out the best way to describe that style of writing. And it just the best way I can phrase it is unnaturalistic. People don't talk like this writing looks on the page. I am almost certain that if you were to meet Oscar F. Knight back in the early 1960s when he was writing this, that he would not say things like, "Such a friendship has been established through the years with Mr. and Mrs. Ken Holiday and myself," or my favorite sentence maybe ever in the history of this podcast is, "Our plans for a fishing trip to this lake culminated into action." So, I mean, and sometimes I get hung up on writing, and I think the writing and the presentation of these things is oftentimes just as interesting and sometimes more interesting than the flying saucer stories themselves. So in my mind, I don't know if you do this. I do this. I will rewrite things sometimes in my mind almost as an exercise. How would I write this? Or if I was editing this, how would I advise an author to rephrase it? It might go something like this. Among our friends, Mr. and Mrs. Ken Holiday are the ones with whom we spend the most time engaging in outdoor activities. One day, we decided to go fishing in Moose Lake, in the Great Western Divide in Sequoia National Park, which is 12 miles east of park headquarters along the Wolverton Trail. This area contains many virgin areas of beauty. So, yeah, you can make it simpler. You can summarize. You can sort of cut the sort of rhetoric and get to the main action. But I don't know. I took a few minutes to come up with that, and I honestly don't like it as much as what Knight wrote here. So, you know, there's a balance to wordiness versus concision. I've no evidence that Oscar Knight was a prolific writer. This might have been the first narrative like this he had composed. And if so, it's great. And if he's trying a little hard to make it sound writerly, then good. That's better than no effort at all, which is kind of what I put into my rewording of it. In any case, this is neither here nor there, but it is a little bit of an insight into what goes through my mind when I'm working on these episodes. Because to be honest, sometimes it's hard for me to turn off the part of my grade that is grading things all the time. So let's see what happens. The action begins on the evening of July 1st, 1955. Oscar and Ken were camped in Wolverton Meadow. They were alone. No one was closer to them, except a pack station about a mile down the road. They ate supper, they laid out their bedrolls, and they knew, quote, "No one went up or down past us that night." The next morning, they ate breakfast, they packed up their stuff, they get out on their way. They're 3 miles out from the station, and they're at between 85 and 9,000 feet elevation. So the air is kind of thin, or rarefied, as Knight puts it in his book. Rarefied is a word that people should use more. But the air's thin. So they have to take breaks. They lay the packs on a log, they settle down, and they rest. And this is where Oscar sets the stage visually for the events that are to come. Here, the trail is wide and clear, and looking up ahead about 1/4 mile, Panther Gap was in view, our sight of it being little obstructed at this point except for a few pine trees. Here, my companion and I made a careful observation of the trail, taking note we were still quite alone. Right here, an event of destiny was to take place in the lives of two fishermen, and to be forever branded with clarity in their memories. So we know something is going to happen, and I love the way that they set that out. And I think this is something that you could argue is sort of overwritten or sort of embroidered a bit, but I don't think so. Okay, it's possible that I'm being a little too much essay grading-ish on this, but I don't know. I like it. So what happened? What happened that would be forever branded with clarity in their minds? No one was on the trail, yet we were now startled to see a finely dressed gentleman coming down trail and not over 50 feet above us. He noted from our surprised features we were mystified at his sudden appearance and made some comment on it. Now, when I first read this, I was I wasn't sure what was going on, because was this the start of the event or was this something else? They see somebody else on the trail. The person made some comment on it, and they don't say what the comment is. So you think this is kind of a throwaway thing, but then it continues. At once, certain things became apparent to us. The stranger was not dressed for this wild woodland setting. From somewhere, he had come from a dressing room. Low-topped Oxfords, brown in color, brown pants of a heavy drill like whipcord, neatly pressed, light blue shirt, old-fashioned wraparound dress tie. His eyes were different from any I had ever seen, a clear, transparent brown that one looked into with depth, not opaque like ours. It was easy to place his height at 6 feet 2 inches, and he was around 200 pounds in weight by our standards. A finely featured face that shone with strength and beautiful character, and we would have placed his age in the late 20s except for a point that would throw our guess off. Brown hair, but above his temples a fringe of gray that gave us the feeling that we had no way of knowing this man's age. He wore neither coat nor hat, and it was certainly obvious that he had not slept in his clothes, nor did he have any pack on his back, nor food and water with him. So there's a couple of things about this. Now, because of the title, a visitor from Venus, we know, I mean, at this point, we're pretty sure that the strangely dressed person on the horse that appears out of nowhere is probably the visitor from Venus. We sort of got that established in our head. But what's interesting about this, what I think is interesting anyway, is that he's not wearing a jumpsuit. He's not blonde. The hair detail is great. Brown hair, but then a fringe of gray above the temples, which made it difficult to predict his age. And maybe this is just because I'm rereading some of these comic books right now. But this really, the first thing in my head was, well, this is clearly Reed Richards from the Fantastic Four. It's Mr. Fantastic, because who knows how old Reed Richards is? It bounces all over the place, but he's got that gray on the temples that makes him look older than he might be. But we've got a guy here out on a horse, a big guy, 6'2", 200. That's sizable. And I was 6'2", 200 about 20 pounds ago, but he's a big guy. So it's interesting, and he's not dressed for the terrain, for the area. It's really strange. And we get the person before we get a spaceship, any of that. So what happens when they meet this person? What does their encounter look like? Ken and I were familiar with the terrain of this mountain area, and our new friend began asking questions in a manner we had never known of anyone. His clipped and precise phrasing of words, cutting each word separately, was so noticeable, and as the questions came, a feeling came over me that by thought transference from my mind, he had the answer before it was given. The courtesy of his well-modulated voice as he would ask, "Gentlemen, where are you going? Gentlemen, how high is that peak?" It was as if he had but recently learned our language. Looking at this, I don't know, how am I looking at this? Looking at this as someone who, okay, let's say that I did not know that this was called A Visitor from Venus, and I'm reading this. At this point, the strange clothes, the appearing seemingly out of nowhere, the sort of out of date look, He's healthy. He's fit. He's obviously not starving, even though he doesn't seem to have any sort of supplies with him. Even the clipped tone of voice, as if he had recently learned our language. This doesn't say alien to me at this point. It says somebody very strange, and it's a strange occurrence. In fact, this, I think, might be a little more off-putting to me than seeing somebody who is clearly some sort of space brother type of person in a jumpsuit and reading your mind and everything. Although it does talk about the thought transference, but it doesn't give any examples. It doesn't really delve into that very much, which is kind of disappointing. But let's go on. So the visit is over, and they said, Knight says, quote, "We were to go on with our minds searching for answers as to whom our meeting had been with. How little did we know that the mystery was to deepen for the time being," end quote. So the mystery is deepening. That is good to know. We keep going. They're hiking all day on the north rim of Bucks Canyon, and the bottom of that canyon is the middle fork of the Kaway River. Across from them, he says, the Milk Peak Ridge extended to a distance in the eastern and westerly directions, and all the way to the east, we've got the towering Triple Divide Peak. It's a really good description of the landscape around. It's almost like we don't have room to illustrate this with a map, so I'm trying to paint sort of an image of where we were, if you want to go to this area. So they get to near the Great Western Divide, and Mr. Holliday, his partner, lays down the pack, suggesting, quote, that we should climb the short distance over a steep barrier in the morning. At this vantage point, the sun was shining, but down in the great gash below us, shadows were creeping in to warn of the night's approach, end quote. I love that phrasing. Shadows were creeping in to warn of the night's approach. So they decide, okay, we're gonna bunk out here. We are going to tackle this this steep climb that we have to do in the morning. Let's get a good night's sleep. Let's be at peace for a while before we tackle some hard work. And the problem is, in any story with a title like Visitor from Venus, you're not gonna get much peace in the nighttime. Suddenly, I called out in amazement, for five or six moving blobs of light were rising up the sides of the large rock, and near these, a long string of softly glowing lights, so close together they blended, appeared as if they were coming from some sort of portholes. The smaller lights came to rest on the big rock surface, while the huge object, which I estimated to be a quarter of a mile long, began very slowly rising up to a point about one-third of the way up the shoulder of Milk Peak Ridge. And there it stopped. As I read this for the first time, it occurred to me that I don't know if I have encountered, at least for this show, or honestly anywhere else, I don't remember much of my saucer reading before I started this show. It's all sort of faded into the mists of time, but I don't recall another situation where we have a supposedly visitor from Venus, a space brother type, appear and talk to the experiencers, and then separately we have sort of a UFO sighting. I don't want to say a regular UFO sighting, but what might seem to be a more traditional lights in the sky experience. It seems to be happening a bit the wrong way around. And as I think about it, as I thought about it rather, I kind of recalled, and it's been a while, that the Orfeo Angelucci story had sort of, you know, there were events that took place on subsequent days, and we, you know, eventually get to the point where he has the encounter with humanoids. George Adamski, again, there are sightings, and then there is the meeting with Orthon at Desert Center. But this, where you have the meeting and you have the sighting subsequently with no seeming connection between the two things, I'm not sure there's been another one like this that I've experienced. Now, as they see this, Oscar and his friend Mr. Holliday don't know how to react. Thoughts were racing through our minds to which we could give little expression, so great was our loss for words. What were we seeing at what we judged was about 1 mile distant? Very tired, we rolled into our sleeping bags after some 20 minutes. The lights were still in the canyon. Well, they're braver than I would be, because I'm not sure I could successfully go to sleep if the lights were still out there. So the next morning, July 3rd, they were hoping to discover what the lights were or where they came from, and they looked all around, but they couldn't see anything unusual about the area. Knight notes that their camping and fishing was a success, even though, he says, quote, the fishing was relegated into the background of our minds, which still tried to answer the questions as to what had been observed, end quote. So they're still thinking about this, still trying to figure out what's going on. And then on the way back, the mystery deepens. On the way back, our astonishment could not have been greater, for whom we were to see in almost the same spot, but our genial friend coming up the trail, this time riding a horse. Having been a cowboy for several years, it was plain to me he had not ridden a horse before. The stirrups had not been adjusted to suit the length of his long legs, so his knees were placed forward and too high, throwing his body out of good balance in the saddle. One hand held the reins very loosely and rested on the pommel. From the smile on his face, it was evident that he was enjoying himself. Stopping the big roan mare in a diagonal position across the trail, he said to us, "Gentlemen, you see I am riding a horse today." So things are getting stranger and stranger. It's not just that there's a strange man who speaks in a weird, broken sort of way, but now he's got a horse, which is especially sort of strange, but he seems happy about it. He seems pretty happy about it. So they decide to engage their mystery friend with a little more conversation. I noted the large, full eyes and wide head of this noble horse, and from her looks she seemed to bear a great love shining through her eyes so expressively for everything around her. Here we got in the only question to him, and that was if he had climbed Alta Peak. His quiet answer was, "Yes, gentlemen, I climbed it yesterday." Again, we were to reply to several of his questions regarding the scenery and our luck. Knowing he was so unfamiliar with horses, I wondered by what means he would start her and was totally unprepared for what he did. Touching with his hand lightly along the pole on the left side of her neck, he spoke with gentle manner, "Now, sweetheart, now, girlie, come on, let's go." And in an understanding way, she headed up the trail. Will wonders never cease? Why hadn't she tried to go back toward the corrals? It's such a strange encounter, and that's sort of the end of the encounter with this being, this man, this space, brother or person. And it's fascinating because we talked about the thought transference that Oscar Knight mentioned earlier, but he didn't have any examples, specific examples, of how he got the answer to the questions he was asking the two men from their minds before they could respond. Oscar mentions that might have happened, but he doesn't really provide an example. Now, the sort of mental psychic energy or abilities of this being, we see it here rather with the relationship, the connection between the man and his horse. So It's interesting, and that's sort of where this encounter ends. Now, as we parted company with regret, questions were to come more than ever concerning this being who had left such a deep impression on us. Never did my mind cease to search for the answers over which the dawn of light was to come gradually as my wife and I became deeply interested. So where and how did Knight and his wife Kitty try to find information about this? Well, they began to get involved in looking at UFO books and books about flying saucers. And something that I think this is what makes the connection between what happened to Oscar and his friend out on the trail and the wider world of flying saucers and especially visitors from space, what makes the connection for them seems to have been a page or a section from Donald Kehoe's 1955 book, The Flying Saucer Conspiracy. This encounter took place in 1955. Knight's book comes out in 1963. So he reads Kehoe's book and he sees a section that he quotes as being the same as what he might have seen in the sky. And he quotes it briefly, a phrase or two in his pamphlet. But for clarity's sake, this is sort of an expanded selection of Kehoe's writing about what seems to have been other people having sightings of things at the same time that Oscar Knight was. On July 29th, the huge saucer raced past Morro Rock in Sequoia Kings National Park, its brilliant yellow glow lighting a nearby canyon. According to press reports, Park Superintendent E.T. Skoyan saw an enormous UFO zoom into the sky. Its diameter, he estimated, was at least 1,000 feet. On the next three nights, other park officials saw the huge machine, or a similar one, as it streaked over the area. Simultaneous reports from Visalia and other California cities confirmed Skoyan's estimate. To have been visible so far, the saucer must have been gigantic. Now, the dates don't quite match up. Knight's encounter was at the beginning of July. Kehoe's report talks about things that happened at the end of July and then subsequently into August. But similar types of sightings, similar area. And there is some corroboration, which we will get to. But to end, Oscar closes his account on page 9 with the following. Oh, friends of ours, as you read this message, comes the dawning of a new age, for we are God's children. In these latter days and the fulfillment of his prophecies, he gives us signs of the times and the skies. Matthew 7, verse 7. Ask, and it shall be given you. Seek, and ye shall find. Knock, and it shall be opened unto you. Oscar Knight. A new age is dawning. Things are happening. It's spiritual. It's connected to God, and we are all God's children. Prophecy will be fulfilled. This is a significant event, and he connects this to his encounter with this strange man who was on a horse and or not on a horse, depending on which day we're talking about. But we don't get an expansion of the message. We don't get really any proselytization. There's a verse from the Gospel of Matthew, and that's about it. It's clear, I think, reading this, that Oscar Knight and those around him were profoundly affected by what they saw. But one of the interesting and I think very refreshing things about this is that he doesn't spend hundreds of pages trying to persuade us of what he saw. He doesn't provide detailed descriptions of a craft. He doesn't run down the layout of the control room or talk about how it flies. We just get the impression that this affected him in a deep way that he is not entirely able to put into words. And so he's trying to find some kind of framework, whether it's the New Testament, whether it's Donald Kehoe's Flying Saucer books, to try to understand. And I think one of the most fascinating things about this is I have no idea why he called this story a visitor from Venus, because there's no mention of Venus here. There's just almost an assumption that flying saucers with a crew, that make contact with people on Earth generally are from Venus. That has sort of crept into the thinking here. That's the only thing I can imagine, because there's no other real discussion of where this being is from. And we don't even have any direct testimony that the person that Oscar and his friend met on the trail has any connection to the flying saucers. That seems to be something that is largely conjectural. So following Knight's account, we have a letter from a Mr. Carl J. Bueller, who was mentioned in the introduction. And Bueller wrote this letter to Oscar and Kitty Knight in February of 1963, and in part, it reads as follows. Dear Mr. and Mrs. Knight, from 1951 to 1959, I served the National Park Service as a ranger at the Ash Mountain entrance to Sequoia National Park. In addition to my official duties, I was a member of the Ground Observer Corps, and all sightings of any type of aircraft were reported immediately to our filter center in Bakersfield, California. It was during this period of service that I did write the report concerning the appearance of a cigar-shaped air vehicle which appeared 4 days in succession and maneuvered around Morro Rock. The park superintendent phoned the Fresno National Guard Air Force Unit, and jets were scrambled which were airborne within a matter of minutes, and, as if warned by radar, the vehicle took off at a fantastic speed and disappeared within a matter of seconds. Bueller notes that this was the source of the account in Kehoe's book, and Bueller himself concludes that this was, quote, undoubtedly the mothership of a number of smaller UFOs, flying saucers, that were sighted many times by hundreds of persons in the park, and I believe these to be of extraterrestrial origin. So what do we make of this? This is a very interesting brief encounter. Like I said, I don't see within the text itself here any connection between the person that Knight encountered and the UFOs which they saw, although it seems entirely natural and, I don't know if rational is the right word, but sensible to sort of connect those things. And the corroboration of the sightings is also very, very interesting. But the Knights did become interested in the UFO scene. The correspondent who put me on the trail of this said that they had met the Knights in the 1960s when Kitty, Oscar's wife, came to witch a well, sort of douse for water on their ranch. They would visit the Giant Rock Convention, and around 1970. My correspondent received a copy of this book, from Kitty when they were at church together, the Methodist Church in Porterville, California. And my informant said that the book was announced in the church bulletin, which is just great, because this sort of indicates that this isn't the actions and the writing and the story of somebody who is attempting to make it big on the UFO circuit and searching for information in newspapers and such about the Knights didn't really lead me to anywhere UFO related. I found a little bit of information, and it seems that based on an obituary of Oscar's father, J.A. Knight, who died at the age of 89 in 1955, it seems that the Knight family had been originally from Alabama, and Knight's father had been born in Alabama in 1866. He became a teacher and migrated to California. He was a member of the Tular, California First Baptist Church. His wife, Molly, survived him, and he had six children, including Oscar Knight and his wife Kitty. Now, Kitty's mother lived to be 100 years old, according to an article about her 100th birthday that came out in May 6th, 1965. Kitty's mother, Adela Sager Kurth, would die later that year on December 3rd of 1965. And that's about all I could find about these folks, apart from what my correspondent shared with me. And I think it's this is the kind of story that I like to say that we need more of, but that there it's hard to find these things because you've got privately published booklets that disappear before they are ever preserved and scanned and things. And you also have people who might have told stories like this to friends, to family, but who didn't write it down, who might have been embarrassed to, or just didn't feel the need to write it down. It's a personal event that is personal to them. And I think those stories are among the most fascinating aspects of the saucer life. If you like The Saucer Life and want more, you can support the show in exchange for some bonus content. Patrons over at patreon.com/cheezomedia get the episodes before everyone else. There's bonus content of some kind every month, and you can check it out at patreon.com/cheezomedia or via the link in the show notes. Over at saucerlife.com, you can get past episodes, or you can also get them on your favorite podcast app. If you search for Saucer Life on most social media sites, you'll find us. But in these days of social media madness and idiocy, it would be wonderful if you just chose to email us at thesaucerlife@gmail.com. You can also contact us by post at Cheezo Media, P.O. Box 68, Grand Blanc, Michigan, 48480. And thank you for listening. Remember to send in any questions and comments. I love getting those. And our associate producer is Simpson J. Hanover III. Saucer Life is a production of Cheezo Media, LLC. Cheezo Media, our heart is with the people. Until next time, keep watching the skies, because the skies are watching you.